Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
When today's guest was 6 years old, she drowned and was declared dead by a lifeguard. This took place in a man-made lake near her hometown in Germany. It was only later in her life that Karin Vastola recognized this as a turning point in her life. Today, she lives in Yuba City, California, where she is a massage therapist and clinical Ayurvedic specialist, but mostly she practices mind medicine, helping people on issues that deal with the mind. Yuba City is home to many Sikhs and Punjabis, and she meditates in the Sikh temple there. Karin Vastola has now written a book about her experiences, Journey to the Tenth Gate, Life with Guru Gobind Singh, A Spiritual Awakening. In her book, she encourages readers to practice meditation and describes breathing exercises to help cultivate mindfulness. Karin Vastola, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, because you emphasize the importance of meditation and of breathing,
what
kind of breathing do you recommend for somebody who maybe this might be a new practice for them to do breathing exercises?
So when I first meet somebody and they're having issues like the mind, they just cannot silence their mind. I always say there are as many breaths as there are people. So generally I start with, I have people just focus inward when they start to breathe. So they develop an awareness of their breath. And in all reality, well, at one point we all breathe. So it's just that we gain awareness how we breathe, how deep the breath is, how long we breathe in, and then how long we breathe out. And, you know, we can do different things. We can take a long breath in, hold it for a moment, or breathe out shortly. Or we can breathe in shortly and then hold it in longer. And when we hold the breath longer, we become more relaxed. The mind becomes more relaxed. And breath is a focus point. To me, that's a big thing. That's how I start with people, so that people have an idea how to focus, because the mind just races oftentimes and people are very agitated. So I say, take a deep breath in, and oftentimes I count, and then I tell them to hold, and then I tell them to breathe out. And then the main thing at this moment is follow your breath into the body. And once you've done about 10 breaths, you have an awareness. You become aware of your breathing. And I think in this process, we develop an awareness of the body itself. And then I just tell people, focus. Do you have a pain? Do you need to readjust your body? Do you need to calm? Go ahead.
You suggested a pause in between the inhalation and exhalation. Just now, you suggested the pause. Yes. But in your book, you say at first, maybe just the in-breath and the out-breath.
Yes.
And you say maybe inhaling and exhaling, counting to five. But a lot of times, that's longer than people can hold, can inhale and exhale when they're starting out. So what about I start trying counting to 10 and I can't make it to 10?
That's all right. It's not a big deal. It's not about the number. It's about how you are feeling. How does the body feel? If you start getting out of breath, you're finished. Don't go there. You don't have to go there. It's really easy. It's breathing. And breathing is comfortable and easy. And then when you become a little bit more schooled and your lungs are developing, I've trained myself to do 1.5 breaths per minute these days. And it took me about 4 or 5 months to get there. So of course, when you first start out, don't breathe like I breathe. Breathe like you breathe and how you are comfortable within yourself.
Well, you say that when people are doing that, it might take a week or two of daily practice to slow down the breathing. And then you say the next step, breathe in, count to five, hold the breath, count to five, exhale to the count of 10. In other words, double the number to the exhale. And lengthening the exhalation in relation to the inhalation is very relaxing. And I thought when I was doing things like that, the only time I can imagine wanting to do the opposite, and that is inhale longer and exhale shorter, would be if you were an actor and wanted to present yourself as being anxious on stage as an actor.
Yes.
You might be that
way. Sounds good.
But otherwise, it would be very desirable to double the count of the exhalation.
Yes.
So you might breathe in counting to five, hold counting to five, exhale counting to 10. So this is what you recommend in your book.
Yes.
And you say eventually holding the breath for the same length of time as the exhalation.
Mm-hmm.
And you say the space between the breaths is where we begin to feel stillness.
Yes. Yes.
And you suggest that this is a starting point for meditation.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Now, you're a longtime meditator, and so you have your meditation practice has evolved what works for you.
Yeah.
But what would you advise, because you do advise people, helping them on issues that deal with their mind.
Mm-hmm.
What do you advise people as far as, I'm sure you encourage them to meditate.
Yes, absolutely.
And how do you tell them to do this?
How is, just take, okay, most people, when I tell them I meditate, I sit for an hour, sometimes two. Most people start with 5 minutes. Even if 2 minutes, that's enough. Because if you can tell your mind just to be quiet for that amount of time, and the mind won't be quiet at first. It just doesn't, not when you're starting.
I think a lot of us are familiar with this pattern, Karen.
So, but you know what I tell people? Go, oh, I can't find this piece. Did you sit for 2 minutes and did you breathe for 2 minutes? And if you had 1 second of that time where you felt at total peace, and I really mean 1 second, then you are there. The time doesn't matter, because when you meditate, in true meditation, you lose a sense of time. Time doesn't exist. Time is made that we made, humanity made this up, which is a good thing. We need time as a, you know, it tells us when we need to go to work in the morning and things like that. But time itself is what we perceive within the mind. Have you ever sat in a movie when the movie was so good, you were so drawn in, you sit and all of a sudden it's like, oh, it's already 2.5 hours. What happened to the time? See, time is really relevant. It really, we stretch it, or we do with time what we want to do, but it's up to us. And I know this is a greater concept, but when we, you know, we follow a schedule and a time, time is great. But we also have our own time. And that's what I'm talking about here.
My guest is Karen Vastola, and she lives in Yuba City, and she helps people on issues that deal with the mind. And she's been telling us about breathing as a starting point for meditation. And Karen, many, many years ago, I was on a university campus. I saw a sign where they were going to start transcendental meditation lessons. And so I signed up. I was eager to learn meditation. I was a terrible failure being able to sit for 20 minutes with a calm mind, even with the mantra that they gave. But also, I was curious in your book when you recommend how to select a teacher, because these were young kids themselves. They couldn't have had a very long meditation practice. And I'm sure they were glad when I graduated, because I had so many questions that they couldn't answer. So you help people, probably like me, who couldn't sit. Well, in fact, 20 minutes, they tell us to start 20 minutes. Whereas what you just said, don't even attempt that long, because then you get discouraged right away. So you suggest 5 minutes. And then I think, oh, okay, Karen, I can do 5 minutes.
Right.
So then what would you tell me to do? Would you give me a mantra to repeat?
You know, I personally, because I go to the Sikh temple and they have a tradition and they call Simran. So what I say is I say God's name, which is in Punjabi, Waheguru. But you can do anything, whatever suits you. And it helps you to focus. It brings your mind to a point. And then once you get better, you know, so anything that works for you, you can say God's name in any language or any way that you want, that you feel comfortable. And if you do that for 5 minutes and that brings you peace, then you have achieved something great because you silenced your mind. And that's the whole idea about meditation to begin with. But there is so much more during meditation. Sometimes I hesitate to even talk to people about what happens during meditation. Either people totally think I'm way out there and walk away, or people go, oh my God, this is possible. And I go, absolutely. Because can I go into it a little bit?
Yes.
So when I meditate, and because I have been meditating for quite a while, for like 5 minutes, I sit, I may say, I do Simran, and I say Wahe Guru, a couple of times, and then my mind goes quiet. And then what happens? I get this feeling of total peace and bliss. I actually lose feeling of my body. My body in that moment does not exist. And I really am just purely in the mind. The mind is everything that is what I'm aware of. But I go beyond the mind and I go out into the universe. And this is what I call sitting with God. I look out into the universe and I sit with God and I feel the presence of God. And I know some people may have a hard time with that, but this is what I feel. This is what I experience during deep meditation. And I do this every day.
But now, Karen, you're an experienced meditator. And
yes.
If I'm new to this,
yeah.
I see photographs of people sitting and staring at a candle flame. Do you
yes.
ever recommend that?
You know, absolutely. If you are a beginner and you are even just have a hard time closing your eyes, hey, put a candle about 5 feet in front of you and look at the flame, look into the flame and see. And you are going to be so drawn in very quickly. I mean, it's powerful. This is a really easy and simple exercise. You are drawn in and the world disappears around you. And if you haven't done that before, do it. Practice. Take a candle and see what happens. You're going to be surprised and you're going to be happy.
Well, you see photographs of somebody staring seriously with crossed eyes and meditating like they're really making a lot of effort.
Yes.
And it looks like a joke, but I do find that if I look into that space between my eyebrows,
mm-hmm.
I find that really is calming for me. And it doesn't seem to be logical, but it does seem to work. If I look up into that space, it's called the third eye.
Yes.
Sometimes I see colors, and I find that is a helpful technique for me.
Yes. Now that is a powerful technique. It really, truly is. Because when I have a hard time going and focusing, because sometimes I do too. Something is going on in my life that just takes a little bit more of my attention. And I go, okay, I got to use another tool. What I do, I look towards the third eye. So my eyes are closed. I'm bringing my eyes together. And then I look about 10 inches outside of me. So I'm pushing my sight not just to the third eye, but I push it about 10 inches outside. And I watch what happens outside of that. And that brings me within seconds. Once I've learned this technique, and once you've learned this technique, when you push your sight outside 10 inches in front of you, you're there. You are focused instantly. At least that's what happened to me. I mean, when I do this and I need to focus, even let's say I have to do something like talk to somebody or something and I'm pretty nervous, I breathe a little bit. Then I go to my third eye. I look through my third eye 10 inches out and instantly I'm there. I'm focused. I am collected. And I know exactly what I want to say or what I have to say. I have clarity.
My guest is Karen Bastola, and she is the author of a book, Journey to the Tenth Gate, Life with Guru Gobind Singh, A Spiritual Awakening. After a break, I'll be back with my guest, Karen Bastola, and we'll continue our conversation. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Karen Bastola, who lives in Yuba City and meditates at the Sikh temple there. And in your book, you refer to your doubt about organized religion.
Yes.
And you've used the word God a couple of times since we've been talking.
Yes.
And I just wonder, how do you reconcile this? Do you still have doubt about organized religion?
Well, okay. Now, truthfully, what I do now, I don't. Organized religion is organized religion. It doesn't matter what it is or where it is. It's still organized religion. I just anymore, I focus on God. I don't focus on the outside of, because organized religion is just that. And it helps people. If people who need it, good for them. But that's just outside of my realm, outside of my comfort zone. So I just don't go towards organized religion. That's just not my, that's not my path anymore.
Well, what about, Karen, I'm listening to you and you say the word God and I kind of tighten and can
yes.
you, do you have other terms for people who might resist that term? Can you give us some other term that people might say, oh, now I understand what she's talking
about? Okay. How about universal energy? That's another term. How about if you are a Christian, you can call on Jesus Christ. That's up to you. Whatever you are comfortable with, you want to find that's what's dear to your heart. And that's where you want to go. And that's where you're comfortable. And that's where you're going to meditate and be most successful.
Well, one reason I could see why you wouldn't be too fond of organized religion, because you say in your book, and you don't go into detail, but you say that you were abused in childhood while
yes.
under the care of church officials.
Yes, 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 true. I was.
That's heartbreaking.
Yes, thank you. Yes, it was. I mean, it took me a long time to get over that. And so I've never been a friend of organized religion. I'm not. But see, there are different people, different needs. And if you have not had such an experience, more power to you. But to me, this was a lesson. It was my path. And this path brought me actually to the Sikh temple in Yuba City.
Yeah, how did you end up? I mean, you were born in Germany.
Yes, I was.
And you end up in this town in California.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, so about some 40 years ago, I came to America. I got married. I got married to a soldier whom I met in Venice, of all places, in Italy. And I got married, lived a happy life, and then it just ended, and it was over. So then I just had to decide to make a living, to do things, to actually, believe it or not, in Sacramento, I started a sandwich company because we were pretty poor and pretty hungry, my daughter and I. And
Karen, that was an interesting story because you were kind of at your wit's end. And you ask for guidance, if I'm stating it correctly.
Yes.
And that's how it was, as if this idea came to you to make sandwiches.
I know this sounds, it's pretty funny, believe it or not. I was at my wit's end. My daughter came home one day and said, "Mom, when are we going to have food in the fridge?" And that hit me. That hurt me. I thought, oh my God. And I said, that night I went to bed and I kneeled down in front of the bed and I said, "God, I need help. I need serious help." I had a dream that night, and in that dream, it was literally laid out for me. And this is no joke. It was laid out for me to make sandwiches, where to go, what businesses to visit, what to tell people. And I mean, it was like a business plan totally laid out for me. And I followed that. I was not feeling at that time. I was kind of sick that time. This was like Christmas, a little bit before Christmas. And then in January, I decided the end of January, I was going to start a sandwich company. And that's exactly what I did according to my dream.
And you even had a space provided rent free for this business. So it's like the universe was supporting you.
Yes. It was quite interesting. And I tell this story often and people go, "Wow." People tell me, "Your faith must have been strong." And it's like, my faith is strong. My faith is, it's not bendable. I can't veer off my faith. That's,
Well, you also say that seemingly without knowing the reason why, I ended up in the temple in Yuba City.
Yes.
Now I know I was led to this place, this temple, at this time in my life. So it was from Sacramento that you moved to Yuba City?
Yeah, from actually to Marysville first, and then I moved to Yuba City. And in 2002, I had a friend who said, "You like to meditate. They're having a meditation class at the Sikh temple in Yuba City. Let's go." And I said, "Sure, let's sign me up." So we went a couple of days. I can't remember. It was probably Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, or maybe Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I can't remember exactly. This was in 2002. And from that day, I went to the Sikh temple, and I cannot tell you exactly what happened. It was just something like a feeling that I thought, this is truly amazing. I felt like I was coming home. I don't know how or why, but it just felt like I had been missing this and I was home.
My guest is Karen Vastola, and she is telling us about her experiences and her book that she has written, Journey to the Tenth Gate, Life with Guru Gobind Singh, A Spiritual Awakening. Now, we've used this term Sikh several times already, and I'm not sure everybody listening, Sikh, what are they saying? S-E-E-K? Tell us, for people who might not be familiar with it.
It's the Sikh religion. They call their temple. The actual word for temple is Gurdwara. And in the Gurdwara, I go every day. And Sikhs, S-I-K-H, this is the religion. Sikhism is the religion. And remember, I'm not joining because of the religion. I'm joining because of the prayer that I say and what I get from this prayer and the experiences that I feel within, the deeper movement within, the emotions, the heart feeling that I get when I sit inside this Gurdwara and meditate.
You also tell us that this word means student. The term means student in Persian Punjabi.
Yes.
And I like that concept that you're a student. You're not a religious fanatic.
No, I'm a student. Yes. Yeah. Yes, I am. I'm glad you remember that because it's true. I am a student.
Well, I really like the cover of your book, Karen. And you give the name, somebody named Valdez.
Yes, Michael Valdez.
And would you describe Michael's picture for us, his illustration that's on the cover of your book?
The illustration is, it's the 10th guru of the Sikh religion. His name is Guru Gobind Singh. He was a 10th guru, and they had 9 gurus before him. And when he died, with his death, he decided that all the writings from the previous gurus, they were put together not all gurus wrote, but most of the gurus had some wisdom they put together. And it's really a neat book. It's the Guru Granth Sahib. That's the holy book. And that was then, from then on, after his death, this was going to be the guru for the Sikh religion. This was going to be the teacher for the Sikh religion. And
You're telling us who he was, but yeah. I was asking if you could describe the cover. Describe Valdez's illustration.
So he has a man's face with a beard. He wears a turban, and it has some ornaments on the turban. The turban is mostly blue with a yellow golden ring around. And then he has a halo. The halo is yellow. It's really a beautiful drawing and a beautiful picture of Guru Gobind Singh. And then behind the yellow aura, there is it's like a sunrise. I think of it as a sunrise or sunset with the different colors of yellow and orange behind.
Well, Karen, you know what captivated me are the eyes. Michael did such a fantastic job in his illustration of this person's eyes.
Yes, he did. I have to say, he is a really good illustrator. He's really a good artist.
They convey gentleness and even loving, I think.
Yes.
These eyes do, looking at me, the reader, looking at his. Okay, so that's who this is on the cover. This is Guru Gobind Singh.
Yes.
And the subtitle, Life with Guru Gobind Singh, A Spiritual Awakening. Now, you say life with this guru. Didn't you say he died?
He died in 1609. So, yes. And the reason I say life with Guru Gobind Singh, because I got to tell you a story. This was so amazing. In 2008, I decided to go to the temple every single day. I call it temple or gurdwara. So I go every day. I sit, I meditate. I sat for 4 years, and I don't know why I sat. I just felt I had to. In 2012, early in the year, like in March or April, this person appeared. I mean, I opened up my eyes, and there was a beautifully dressed man standing in front of the altar. And I looked at him, and I go, oh, this is not a person from Yuba City. I don't know what he's doing here, but he is dressed like a prince. And then he disappeared. And I didn't know what to think. I was shocked, actually. And then I went into what they call the langar hall, which is a mess hall where they serve food to people. The Sikhs serve food every single day, 365 days of the year. And you don't have to do anything. You just go and eat.
You don't even have to pay.
No, you don't. I tell all the homeless people, go there. You get food and you can stay in that place and you can sit. Nothing is asked of you. And they call this the langar hall. So I went into the langar hall and there was a priest. Now I've known this priest for a few years by then. And I said to him, there was a picture over this man who, where they serve the food over the counter. And I said, who is that man up there in that picture? And the Granthi, which is a priest, he said, this is our guru, Guru Gobind Singh. He is dead long time ago. And I thought to myself, well, what did I just see? If he is dead, what was I seeing? What was I witnessing? I didn't say anything. I ate a little lunch. Then I went back to meditation inside the Gurdwara. And then I went home. About 10 days later, I sit and I come every day. About 10 days later, here is this, I needed to open my eyes during meditation. Here is this beautifully dressed man again. Now this time, first he sat on a chair and then he got up, he walked towards me and he asked me to do something. And I told him, Guru, I don't have the courage to ask people to do something. I just don't have that courage. Because he had asked me to do something, to ask a question to the men who are the board members at the temple. And I told him I didn't have the courage. So, but I thought to myself, before he disappears, I'm going to ask him. I said, Guru, I see you. Guru, I hear you. Guru, why are you speaking to me? And he said, because you listen. And that struck me odd, but it stayed with me. And I thought, this is interesting. I'm listening. And by now I knew who he was because, you know, the people were telling me. And that he is Guru Gobind Singh. And they're telling me his life story. I didn't tell a whole lot of people. Well, at that time, I didn't tell anybody anything. Then he appeared another time. And believe it or not, this time he was my left arm length away. He sat on a horse. So again, I opened my eyes and I see this horse next to me. And I'm thinking, oh, a horse. Now, what in the world? So I looked up and I looked into his eyes and I was so mesmerized. I couldn't move. My eyes, they were like melted and I couldn't move. Time disappeared. Time literally stood still in that moment. And I felt in utter bliss. I was in ecstasy in that moment. And we stayed there, I don't know how long. And nobody ever came into the temple when these things happen. So I looked at the horse and I thought, this horse is odd. It's different. I didn't say a whole lot, but finally, a couple of days later, there was a priest and I said to him, do you see anything when you meditate? And he goes, no, but I watch you sometimes. You see things when you meditate. And I thought, he's right. So I said to him, I saw Guru Gobind Singh on a horse. And he said, first thing he said, what was the color? And I said, oh, it sounds strange. But I said at first, it was white. And I go, but not really. It was light blue. And his eyes got really big. And he said, I believe you. Guru Gobind Singh had a blue horse. And I thought to myself, oh, good, I have somebody who at least confirms what I'm seeing. This was pretty powerful.
My guest is Karen Vestola, and she is describing her meeting with Guru Gobind Singh, who had been dead for a number of years. And, you know, I suspect, Karen, that children have experiences like this, not seeing a guru, but I knew a young woman, more than one, that had an invisible friend. And when I asked her about it some years later, she said, oh, well, that was just my imagination. They dismiss it. So I'm wondering if people maybe have an experience similar to yours, but dismiss it because they think, oh, that's not logical. If I even tell anybody, they'll think I'm crazy. They'll want to lock me up.
Right. That's true. I come that across that all the time. That's why I decided to write it down. I had to have an accounting of what was happening to me because in about 5 years, I would have said, oh my gosh, I made this up. This could not happen. So that's why I started writing it. I wrote it down.
We're going to take a short break and then Karen and I will continue our conversation. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today has suggestions for meditating and breathing as helping de-stress in these stressful times. And let me tell listeners the name of your book again, Karen Vestola, Journey to the Tenth Gate. Now, right away, Tenth Gate? What the heck is the Tenth Gate, Karen?
Okay. I'm glad you're asking that, because the 10th gate in the Sikh religion is the same as the crown chakra in other Eastern religion traditions. So the 10th gate is, we have, according to the Sikhs, we have 9 openings throughout the body. And the 10th gate is the crown chakra. And when I was in my mid-30s, I had my crown chakra opened. I had a Kundalini experience. Are you familiar with Kundalini?
Oh, yeah.
So I had an opening, my crown chakra opened. It literally...
And but you might, I don't know that everybody does, so you might tell what Kundalini means, and of course what your experience of it was.
Mm-hmm. So in the Hindu tradition, the Kundalini is a coiled snake, 3.5 times coiled, sits on the bottom, on the very lowest part of our body. This what they call it, a coiled up snake, and it's an energy, right? Well, this energy unleashed within me, and this was not expected. I had been very, very restless for like a week, and when it happened, it was so powerful. It was like this energy, literally, when I say unleashed, it was unleashed, because I had no clue what happened. And I had surges of energy. It was like my fingers had been plugged into an electric plug, not with 220 volt, but 1,000. It was just crazy. And I had these surging, I don't even know how long it lasted, but it ended up with being a rush. And I was in ecstasy for, this happened about Sunday night. I was in ecstasy literally till Tuesday afternoon.
But now, Karen, you say you were in ecstasy for that time, but what you say in your book, you say the 10th gate opening was involuntary and the most glorious, but also the most painful experience of a lifetime. So what you're describing, ecstasy, but yet you say it was the most painful experience of a lifetime. In what way was it painful?
Okay. The truth is, after my ecstasy wore off, for when I say real ecstasy, it was so powerful that when I touch people, I couldn't feel where their skin began or mine ended. When I was doing massage, it was powerful. People either loved it or hated it. It was just amazing. Because I could touch, and I felt like my hands could go through the body, and it was like that. And some people hated it, and some people loved it. So about 7 or 8 months, this ecstasy slowly, I had a powerful ecstasy, but then it just kind of wore off. After eight months, it was gone. And then I wanted to get this feeling back, and I didn't know how. And I was in desperation. I became seriously depressed. I think that's the only way I can put it. I even thought about suicide. I mean, not right away, but eventually I got to that point. And the only thing that kept me going, really, truly, I have to say, was my daughter, because I knew I had to take care of her. I knew I had to live for her. And so in that sense, she saved me. But also, I went so deep into a depression that I felt like I was sitting in a dark well, and there was no light at the end of this tunnel. I just couldn't see it. And I had to get sick and tired of this. And this lasted about 7 or 8 years. And then I came out of it, because I was just sick and tired of being depressed. And then I really started meditating seriously again. I started to just looking for an alternative to what I had experienced. And then during meditation, I began to experience ease of mind again. My mind wasn't racing. I wasn't looking for things to fulfill me. I didn't need anything anymore. It was just during meditation that I felt at peace. And it was powerful.
My guest is Karen Vastola, and she lives in Yuba City, which is home to many Sikhs and Punjabis. And Karen meditates in the Sikh temple there. She's a clinical Ayurvedic specialist and massage therapist, but mostly she helps people deal with issues of the mind, and you encourage people to meditate. And, you know, something that you mentioned in your book that kind of goes against what we told, there's an expression, if at first you don't succeed, try again. And I've often thought to myself, no, if at first you don't succeed, surrender. Maybe you're beating your head against a wall trying to go down the wrong path. And so I was pleased in your book when you say surrender equals freedom.
Yes.
And so people are probably wondering, well, what do you mean by surrender? I don't want to surrender. I want to try again. So I wonder if you would, Kyren, read from your book the answer to that question, what is surrender? Okay. That's on page 93 in your book.
Okay. So what is surrender? In the dictionary, it says to give up, to yield, to relinquish, lay down, to turn in. Simply put, it means to give up something. In the spiritual sense, what does it mean to give ourselves up? First, we can give up resistance to the way we see the world. Accept how life plays out. Resistance can be felt if we pay attention. A very specific feeling accompanies when we can't accept an issue in life. There is an energy that surrounds us when we resist. What do we yield to when silence is required? What do we give up when we are in a struggle? We might fear anything that's new, which then gives rise to resistance and is felt within the body. Surrender means giving up the energy that stands between us and peace of mind. It's pure energy we give up once we surrender. That frees more energy for other things in life.
This is author Kyren Vastola. She's reading from her book, Journey to the Tenth Gate, Life with Guru Gobind Singh, A Spiritual Awakening. And that section she was just reading was the answer to what is surrender and why would we want to surrender? Why wouldn't we want to fight? I notice so many politicians when they're running, they say they're going to fight for us and fight for us. I think, is that really what they're going to do? So you say the energy of love can be felt as much as electricity can be felt. Now, here's you bring up love. The energy of love can be felt as much as electricity can be felt.
Yes.
People might wonder, well, what do you mean by that, Kyren?
Okay, when you really, really surrender to me, when I surrender, I sit, I open my heart, and I just feel what I'm feeling. And when I hone into the feeling of love, love is an energy. Love is that what runs the world, literally. Love is that what connects us. It's the glue of the world. And I think we lost that sense of love that connects us. But we really feel it. When we tune into it, we feel it. Isn't it sometimes you see a baby and this is the cutest thing you've ever seen and your heart just melts. Now, isn't that a feeling that you can actually feel in your heart and you know it, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. In fact, I've been surprised when some people say, no, I don't feel anything. But when I see, like you say, a baby, a puppy, I feel it in my fourth chakra. I feel it in my heart.
Yes.
And so I think in terms of chakras, you mentioned these, and I can feel that in my heart when I see this lovable little creature.
Yes.
And I wonder if people maybe tuned into their body more, they might experience what you were just describing. And maybe if they don't, it's because it never occurred to them to do what you just suggested.
I think you're right. I think that's the only thing that holds them back is because they haven't thought about it.
Yeah. Well, another question that I have for you after what is surrender is you bring up the topic of duality. And what do you mean by duality, Kyren?
Well, okay, I'll give you a simple example. Okay, you want to buy a jacket and you absolutely love this jacket, right? And you got to have it under any circumstance. Well, you go to one store, they're out. You go to another store and you can't find this jacket or shoes or whatever it may be. So you have a certain expectation. This creates a duality within you. And I know this is very simplified, but just for a moment, the duality I experience within because I can't get these shoes, man, I am really bummed out. I'm just like, oh, I'm beside myself. I got to have those shoes. And on the other side is that part that says, oh, I have surrendered. Why do I need this? Just let it go. But sometimes we are so hooked into something that we got to have it. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be love. It could be a love interest. It could be anything. And when we are disappointed because we have an expectation, we want this thing and we have our mind and I guess the ego set on this. And well, when we talk about ego, then we become obsessed about it. And that's where we create pain within us. I know that was a very simple explanation, but powerful too.
Well, I mentioned that you help people with dealing with the mind. So in a sense, you're a psychotherapist. I know you're not licensed. You wouldn't claim you're a psychotherapist.
Right.
But you have had experiences that can allow you to help other people. For example, you mentioned in your book that, for example, people repeat what they know and what was done to them in childhood.
Yes.
So when somebody comes to you in pain, do you do that? Do you use your own experiences as a child, as an abused child, to help people who are dealing with what was done to them in childhood?
It oftentimes, yes, but also I help them sometimes just to go and remember where they are. And sometimes people are just stuck on an idea and on a moment in life that they can't get over. And what I say is we have a memory in the cellular body, in the cells of the body, we have memory. And since there are so many cells in our body, we have a lot of places to work on. But so when we remember something, oftentimes it triggers us. And then when we are triggered, let's say we're triggered in a bad way, then we argue or we fight or we insist on something because we have a certain belief system. And what I do in my work, I help people to see and to understand so they can see the world from a different view. Like I call it a higher view, a different view, so that they detach and are not attached and are not in duality in that moment. Because in duality, we suffer. And so I help them to see that they can step away from that. And it's a really simple process, but it just needs to be done sometimes.
My guest is Karen Vastola, and she lives in Yuba City. And in Yuba City is home to a lot of Sikhs and Punjabis. And the temple there is a place where you go quite frequently to meditate. And the title of your book that you've written, Journey to the 10th Gate, Life with Guru Gobind Singh, A Spiritual Awakening. And you're telling us your experiences because people might have something similar, but they perhaps think it's their imagination or they're having trouble with maybe their parents. And you suggest that sometimes a person manipulates a situation in the form of an accusation caused by his own guilt. So maybe a parent or both parents are treating their child out of their own guilt. They do things to the child.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, that happened. I see that often. I see how parents manipulate their children, transferring what is really their issue, transferring this to the child and treating the child as if the child is doing something wrong. And but it's really their idea of how the child should behave because they missed out on something or they were mistreated or some issue happened. And it's quite powerful.
Well, you hear stories all the time. Somebody says that when they were a child, what happened, they felt was their fault. Their parents get divorced. They think, oh, that's my fault. And so You are, because of your own experiences, are able to help other people who come to you. And you mentioned your work as a massage therapist. Do you sometimes combine your massage therapy with psychotherapy?
You know what? I used to do more so than I do now. COVID kind of shut a whole lot of things down. So I mostly right now, I just sit and talk with people. And once in a while, you know, if there is something going on that I need to physically touch a person, I will touch a person, but it just, you know, it takes different forms and I never know what it just means. I have a person lay down and I put my hands on them and from there we go. And literally, I don't know where it goes from there. Usually I will have an image. I will have an idea. Something will just come to me on how to proceed with this person in front of me.
When you mentioned that you had dreams that you found would come true and you decided, I don't think I want to know the future. So you let go of those dreams.
Yes.
But you did find that you can, I think, your intuition, if I want to call it that, you're able to help people through that kind of guidance of your intuition. Would that be accurate?
Yes, that is accurate. Yes. Sometimes, let's say I have somebody coming, walking towards me. And in the process of them walking, like the last 6 feet, sometimes, not all the time, but often, I get this like a movie. A movie is opening up in front of me, and I get to see this person's history. And it's quite powerful. It's quite interesting. And I used to do this a lot more. Now I just don't want to see so much anymore because I just don't, because I think this is their life. It is not my life. It's not my business. But if somebody asks for help, then oftentimes I utilize this. It's like opening the book or watching the movie, and I get a real strong sense of their sadness or of something that's happening in their life.
Well, Karen, I would like to leave listeners with this from your book. Two things you say: be kind to yourself, be kind to others, give more than what is expected. And I like to remind myself, be kinder than necessary. Thank you so much, Karen, for this conversation.
Thank you. This was a pleasure.
Remind listeners that the author is Karen Vastola, and her book is Journey to the Tenth Gate, Life with Guru Gobind Singh, A Spiritual Awakening. Thank you, Karen.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.